All right, well, good evening again. Thanks so much for being here. I'm Steve Seal from The Currents, from Minnesota Public Radio. This is our eighth, well, it's actually, we're in our ninth year now of doing Policy in a Pint. And we thank you so much for coming out. Thanks to the Varsity Theater, as always, for being our wonderful hosts and for putting out such a terrific spread for us, as they always do. Policy in a Pint is a co-presentation of The Current and the Citizens League, our wonderful esteemed partners for all these years. There's information about the Citizens League back in the lobby as well. It's something really cool to be a part of. Our sponsors for Policy in a Pint, we thank Target Corporation and also Minnesota Credit Union Network. And again, I'll reiterate, and I'll try to remind myself to do this throughout the course of the evening. Please follow along on Twitter at #PolicyPint, one big long word, no space, dash, anything like that, #PolicyPint. And again, as I said, there's a lot of people we heard from. In all the years of doing these shows, this year, I think, has generated kind of the most interest show by show and kind of heat. It's been so cool to see, as the years have gone on, how many people have just been more and more interested in the topics that we're doing, which is just, you know, so dope as far as I'm concerned, that we're really connecting with the community, we're bringing people together, we're having real conversations while drinking, which is cool. And staying civil, which is, you know, hella awesome as well. So we've done a lot of topics over the years of dire consequence, you know, different aspects of environmental doom and gloom and things like that. And, you know, while this topic tonight is obviously of grave importance, it's actually a little bit different because few looming environmental crises have such a possibility for change that actually rests in our own hands, like this one does. Not completely, obviously, but this one perhaps more so than many. You know, it's not like all due to the power of corporations or governments or, you know, the intransigence of politicians and things like that. These things still play a... this is somebody telling me to shut up, probably, right? Why are you still talking? I'll get to that. Thanks. So, I mean, obviously those things still play a major part in this issue. But we have the power to do something about this one ourselves before any of those entrenched monolithic interests are able to even start doing anything, probably. Bees and other pollinators are disappearing. I think there's probably not a person here that's not aware of the situation tonight. We had so much advance interest, and there are so many groups that are already up and running to do something about this, that's clear. This threatens our entire ecosystem. We know this is the case. We'll talk about why that is tonight, why it is a dire situation, and what we can do about it. What I want to do is sort of take the crisis through the its beginnings, how it was that we got here. As is always with Policy in a Pint, if some of this starts off being a little 101, I apologize, but I like to try to give it a bit of coherence rather than just assuming everyone here is a specialist and knows everything about it. So, our guests tonight, directly to my right here is Gary Reuter from the University of Minnesota's Bee Lab at the Department of Entomology. The goal of the research there is to promote the health of bee pollinators. Joseph Zachman is a research scientist at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and the whole raison d'etre there of his job is working to develop a statewide plan to address the pollinator crisis. And Dara Moskowitz-Grumdahl, senior editor at Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine. She's a multiple-time James Beard Award-winning food writer. You hear her on The Current as well. And if you know her writing, you know that she's just as much an authority on food and dining as she is on farming and things like this. And she's been writing an awful lot about this topic recently. So this is how this works. We're going to... do the usual thing, which is where I interview our guests for 20 minutes or so, and then I'm going to go out and take as many questions as possible. Again, follow along on Twitter, #PolicyPint. Be thinking about your questions when I come out to the audience. I'll get to as many people in as organized a fashion as I can. I'm only one man, and if you have your hand up for a very long time and I miss you, I apologize in advance, but there are going to be some people helping me try to find the people that have the questions, the hands that have been up for the longest period of time. Only one rule: I hold the microphone. Thank you very much. Please don't try to grab the mic. I have henchmen to dive on you now who will make sure that... all right, so... very briefly, I wanted to ask you guys, like, what is your role in this? I've said your titles and sort of my understanding of what your role is for why you're here tonight, but I'll let you put it in your own words and how you got to be in this particular project and what your role in the ongoing addressing of this issue is. And I'll start with you, Gary.
Okay, my job is to come to things like this and talk to people. But the Bee Lab, as you said, we're interested in the health of the honeybees, and we study health, we study diseases. One of the things that we're finding is that the bee health is part of what they need is a better nutrition. And so we branched out, if you will, and we're working together with other agencies trying to increase the habitat. Habitat meaning flowers, which is where bees get their nutrition from. And so we're working to try to make that better for the bees to have a better place to live.
And if anybody wants to jump in and sort of tell the story of, you know, sort of lay the groundwork on what has, where all this started and how we got to where we are, Joe, I'll give you a chance on that as well if you wanted to sort of tell that. And, of course, Dara has written articles about it, too.
Yeah. Gary would probably be in a better position to talk about the history of that, I would think, but I can tell you what our role is at the Department of Agriculture. There are a number of statutes, laws passed by the legislature that direct everything from pesticide registration to the way pesticides can be used, for example, and most recently, at least last year, legislation was passed that directed the Department of Agriculture to conduct a special review of neonicotinoid insecticides and pollinator impacts, as well as develop best management practices for habitat management and development. So our role is to cooperate with folks like Gary and the Bee Lab and the Department of Natural Resources, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, USDA, NRCS, and on and on and on, to develop some understanding of how we could develop expanded pollinator habitat and manage it appropriately so that there's a healthy ecosystem for pollinators in the state.
Say it with me now. Neonicotinoid. We're going to say that many times tonight.
People know them as neonics.
Neonics. I went through neonicotinoid, neozoinkinoid. I've been through many variations of that. So, Dara, since your narrative is one of your strengths, I'm gonna anoint you to sort of take us through the story, even as you did on the radio with us last week on the morning show. So,
sure, my role is village idiot, and what I did was I've been writing about food for many years, and all of a sudden I started looking around. I think about this time last spring, and started saying, "Oh, you know, we're in real trouble. What is going on? Why are the bees are crashing? We don't have any studies about all the non-honeybees. Like, nobody speaks for the non-honeybees." And then I just started, finding out important things such as blueberries depend on pollinators, and other important things such as birds eat pollinators, and birds eat the things that come out of the plants that get pollinated. And I started getting an extremely big sense of worry and concern. And then ever since then, I just go around like the village idiot, village crier, just telling people like, "Hey, let's pay attention here, because we all enjoy eating food and it's going to go away, and we're not even going to have paid any attention when it happened."
So, all right, 2 minutes here to be super 101. What was that?
Do you sleep at night?
I know.
I only sleep at night because I just get worn out.
Yeah. Right. All right, 2 minutes to go super duper 101 here. So what is a pollinator, first of all? When we say a pollinator, what are we referring to?
Okay, this is the birds and the bees. I don't know if I can do it.
Yeah!
So in order for a plant, not... the plant flowers, okay, in order for that plant to produce seed or produce fruit or to produce, reproduce, okay, the pollen has to be taken from one flower to the flower of another plant. And a pollinator is an insect or a mammal or that can do that, because there's also wind-blown pollination, So I guess the wind is a pollinator at some point. So corn, for instance, does not require insects. The wind blows the pollen around and takes care of itself, okay? So pollinators are those insects or mammals. Mammals are like bats, okay, not people, that go around and do that pollination for the plants.
Okay. And the plants are happy about it. The plants provide two things. The plants provide protein, which is the pollen, and they provide nectar. Nectar is sweet, yummy juice, right, that the bugs come and get. And so the plants can't walk around, but the pollinators can, and that's how this all came about, right?
Yep.
And I think it might be a good point now to also distinguish what are called managed honeybee or commercial honeybee colonies, which are moving around to facilitate pollination of certain types of crops in certain locations.
This is one of the ways in which we've industrialized this, is what you're saying.
Correct. Well, actually, let's even backtrack. So there's, for purposes of this, a lot of times I think it's useful to talk about honeybees, which are one thing, and then everything else, which is wild.
And typically honeybees are managed by human beings.
And honeybees come from Europe. Honeybees are not a native species. Honeybees are very important, but they kind of... And they also are the only people that have advocates, I find.
Because they make honey. They make sweet
yes.
stuff. Right. And so they become kind of the symbol, sort of the, you know... the icon of all of this, but there are so many different kinds of bees. You know, there's bumblebees, there's moths, which aren't bees, but there are, like you say, bats. There are other kind of animals that do pollination.
Yeah, there's all
as
kinds
well.
Of bees I never heard of. You know, mm-hmm. Mason bees and leafcutter bees. You guys could probably do this all day.
Okay, so how do we know that they're threatened? When did we first start to discover this, and how do we know this is a problem?
Well, the honeybees, because they're managed, there are beekeepers who are watching them, and they're dying, and they say, whoa, my bees are dying. For the native bees, the wild bees, not quite as easy because nobody's watching every one that goes by. And so there are surveys being done now, and we do know that there are some dangers to the native bees, and they are in decline. But the honeybees are the ones that probably are the indicators because they're being watched more closely.
All right, so
at around 2006, people started noticing, like, oh, my livelihood has disappeared out of this box. And then they started calling it colony collapse disorder, right? And then there became just sort of an international hunt for the reason behind colony collapse disorder.
Okay, so now before we get on to the sort of short list of things that has created the colony collapse, the things that are threatening them, I want to make it clear again why the sort of lay person cares about this, or probably would care if they knew what was happening. The there's this great TED Talk. Your associate, Marla Spivak, by the way, Gary, at the U, has this thing, and you should watch this. If anybody can link to this on Twitter, by the way, I would really recommend it because it's a cool TED Talk she did. By the way, where is she tonight? What is she doing?
Actually, she's in Washington, D.C., talking to the White House.
Awesome!
Yes. And I have...
So that's cool.
I have the update, if you want the update, or we can save it for a big reveal before...
Remind me of a big reveal, and we'll have that at the end.
Okay.
So,
I got the update.
Okay.
Don't update me already. I just said it.
No, I heard from Marla. I know what she's talking about.
Well, basically, so this is obviously something that is just constantly rising in consciousness of citizens and governments and policymakers and groups and all kinds of stuff. So that's a pretty cool bellwether, I think, right there. Okay, so again, in this video, the reason that I bring it up is because she has this very dramatic visual at the beginning this is sort of like a ceiling shot, an overview of a supermarket produce section. And she says, this is our world with pollinators. And then this is our world without pollinators. And there's most everything is missing, basically.
All the good stuff.
All the good stuff. Right, exactly. So pollinators are responsible for?
For zucchini, for melons, for almonds, for every berry you can think of. Every single, I mean, they're everything that's kind of yummy and sweet and out there to lure bugs that we have now decided is super yummy for us, that all comes from the help of little insects.
Okay, so now we've done all this sort of stage setting. Thank you for indulging me on that for the 101. Now, what is it that is threatening them? We have a number of significant processes that are creating the situation. Who wants to tackle that? I suppose you're as prepared as any, really, to talk about this sort of constellation.
I can try to tick them off and rely on my colleagues to help me fill in the empty spaces, but I don't know, you could say there are five, a half a dozen, a number of issues, and if you really want to get big, you could say things like climate change are affecting the issue as well. So we can go big or go small, and we can talk about honeybees or we can talk about, you know, all pollinators. But let's just look at honeybees and the colony collapse disorder that Dara brought up earlier. There are, I'm going to go back to honeybees and the fact that they're a managed species. I've been describing them lately to some people as kind of I don't know if you can think of a dog that's been bred to do certain things. They're actually, they've been bred to do what they do. And just like a golden retriever will eventually suffer from hip dysplasia because it's built into their genetics, there are certain things that these honeybees are vulnerable to. And one of them is a virus, and one of them is a mite. They're also vulnerable to the effects of pesticides used in home gardens and in agricultural settings. They're vulnerable to what else? What do we got, Gary?
There are...
Habitat loss.
Habitat loss, thank
right.
you, which is what we're here to talk about.
So, okay, habitat loss, which has come because of the... a couple of things, really. Primarily the scale of farming in the country, is that would be the number one sort of culprit, and
around
the sort of
here.
Monocultures. When we say that, we're talking about miles and miles all the way to the horizon of corn, for example, that kind of thing, right?
Around here, absolutely. I mean, not in Connecticut, but yeah, definitely around here. I mean, we've lost an amount of prairie equal to the size of Indiana in just the Dakotas and Minnesota since 2008. That's a lot of land.
Okay, so there's that situation, and then just for example, in the arena of farming and big farming, large scale farming, you add on top of that the pesticides which farms simply have used for decades. There's been many different varieties. There's a certain kind. That's where the neonicotinoid word came up earlier. That is often singled out as kind of the one of the big culprits when we talk about pesticides, right? And that's used in large scale farming, particularly corn. Do I understand correctly?
Yeah, corn,
soybeans,
and cotton, other places. Yeah, canola.
Why do neonics, as they say, why does that come up so often? Why is that such I almost said buzzword.
Buzz?
Yeah. I've been telling myself for a month I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. Okay. So, why does it come up as being someone that, like a word that everyone who's interested in the changing this, why does everybody know that word?
Well, I think part of it is that it's relatively new as pesticides go. There's maybe some things that we don't know about it. Some work has to be done on how big of a problem is it. I mean, there are just things that we still don't know about how it affects bees. We know it affects bees. What we don't know is what are the exact parameters. It's not a chemical that's bad in and of itself, okay? But we have to look at how we're using it by controlling the amount that we use and where we use it. I'm convinced that it can be used and not harm the bees. However, I think we've just gotten to the point where I think most people are recognizing that there's an issue, and now the goal is to, okay, now it's an issue. How do we solve the problem? And that's where we're at now.
There are a lot of people who get pretty freaked out about this.
I think the reason people are worried about it is because it's so new. I mean, there's a whole, like, correlation is not causality.
Sure.
But we've gone from a world with no neonicotinoids and lots of bees to a world with
saturation neonicotinoids and vanishing bees in the space of 6 years. And so that's why people are concerned. Whether, you know, where the science will bear out is sort of what everybody's wondering right now, but that's why people are freaked out.
Well, you say a world. What, you know, what are we talking about? Are we talking about, this is a worldwide crisis? Is it primarily a North American crisis? What is it?
It's primarily a developed world crisis, so North America and Europe. In Europe right now, they have a moratorium, not a ban, on neonicotinoids that effectively goes into effect right the second. So this spring is when they're not planting neonicotinoids. And I was talking we were just having a beer before, talking about, will you get any usable science out of a 2-year moratorium? We don't know.
What? All right. So I don't suppose there are people that are, well, no, I know that there are. There is pollination that in some cases is taken over by humans, right? There are people that actually do this, right?
In China, things have gotten way out of control. My, you know, oversaturation pesticide has led to no wild pollinators and no, and so people are literally climbing the trees with little paintbrushes and pollinating flower by flower, and that is a world I don't want to go into.
Now, I want to talk though about what the vested interests are saying, not just chemical companies, but farmers. I mean. Well, I'll cite this example first of all. I got an email a couple of days ago that was from an activist group that said it wanted me to sign a petition to stop Bayer and Syngenta, two big pesticide companies, from proceeding with a lawsuit to overturn a law enacted in the EU to control pesticides. And the argument, basically, on the part of the chemical companies is that the ban is too broad, it's reactionary without regard to the benefit that pesticides can have when used judiciously or properly. What do the farmers have to say in this sort of situation? I mean, they have to control pests, right? So what do we do?
I haven't spoken to every farmer in the state. There are farmers.
You haven't.
Farmers in the state that are just as diverse as the people in this room, and there are a number of them that are very concerned about this issue. Gary and I work on a number of work groups that are trying to pull together best management practices for habitat management, and farmers and farm groups sit on those groups as well, those work groups. And everyone's wrestling, including farmers, with what are they going to do to protect an asset, pollinators, honeybees, an asset to their world, and wild pollinators as well, while also continuing to farm, and how is that all going to be sorted out? So there is, I would characterize it from individual farmers and the farm groups that are represented in some of our work groups, that they're very concerned about this issue as well, and they're looking for some guidance and some leadership on it, both from the Environmental Protection Agency, from the federal government, and from the state of Minnesota.
And there are farmers who can't survive without the pollinators. Right. You will not have apple orchards. You will not have melon farmers. You know, you love going to the farmer's market and getting cantaloupe. Well, good luck if there are no more pollinators. They will not be there anymore. I know of a specialty melon farmer that shut down, and maybe it was just coincidence, but he wasn't getting any set on his melons. And also, a lot of corn farmers don't necessarily have the choice that it might seem as if they do. They have to use the corn that's supplied to them. I mean, there are farmers who are just at war with the seed companies trying to grow their own, you know, not their own seed, and the patented seed drifts into the fin, then they get sued by, you know, so I think there's a lot of farmers who would like to have more options than they do.
Mm-hmm. All right, take some questions again. I think we can go, we'll just verify this, we can go to 7:30? 7:30, okay, awesome.
Right, so my nursery doesn't use neonicotinoids. Is that all I have to worry about? I mean,
yeah, for now. I mean, that's a great thing to do. Just don't, you know, buy plants that don't have neonicotinoids.
There's nothing else. I mean, you said it was basically new.
Don't spray, you know, don't spray poison then on your poison-free plants.
Right, but in terms of buying pre-grown plants, that's the only family that you need to worry about?
Yeah, those are the only pre-pesticide-treated, that's the only pre-treated pesticide that I know of.
Well, no, there are pesticides that are used for everything. The difference between the neonicotinoids is it's a systemic pesticide, which means that let's say you mix in some water, you pour it into the pot, the plant takes it up into the plant, and now it's part of the stems, part of the leaves, part of the, obviously part of the nectar, and part of the pollen. Okay, and the reason that that's such a slick chemical is that exact thing. So now it's in the leaves. The bug comes, eat the leaves, and dies. Okay, and if the level is high enough, then the bee can come, drink the nectar. Nectar is, you know, got the chemical in it. The bee dies, and so it's a great chemical from that aspect. But you don't know when it's gone, right? But
not from the aspect of killing the bee, presumably. But right. Right.
Just because that's free, okay. First of all, the American people need to learn that they have to accept a little bit of imperfection, okay? And, you know, I say that personally because I want people to like me. But for your plants, you know, if you're not willing to have a little hole in a leaf there, a little hole in a leaf there, okay, the only way to do that is to put a whole bunch of chemical on there to kill every bug that ever happens to come around. Okay, so you don't get your plants pre-treated. You bring them home, and now, of course, a bug shows up, and you can't have that. You go to the hardware store and you buy, you know, whatever. I don't even know what they call them anymore. And you spray it, right? And the key is to check on those products and see if they're harmful to bees.
Harmful to yourself or harmful to your children or your dog.
I think you pose an interesting question. Is that the only thing you need to be concerned about? Well, it's the only thing you need to be concerned about if neonicotinoids and bees are the only two things that you're correlating or concerned about. But if you have a neonicotinoid-free plant and then pull something else off the shelf and you look at it and you look it up and say, well, that's not a neonicotinoid, and you spray it on a blooming flower that a bee visits, it could be a product that is also toxic to bees. So it's not the only thing to worry about. I think the mantra that we've been circulating amongst ourselves is if you have the ability, grow flowers, as many as possible, find ones that are bee attractive, and keep them chemical-free.
Gary, you bring up an interesting point, though. There was a report, I think, just yesterday morning on Morning Edition about how there was a spokesman from, I think it was Bachman's, saying if we're not going to use, you know, pesticide A, B, or C, you're starting here on certain plants and on, you know, from here into the future, then there's going to have to be some understanding that your plants aren't going to look picture perfect necessarily. And here we are in a world where we expect our oranges to look picture perfect, our cucumbers to look picture perfect, and our plants and all this. And so it's a different kind of mindset. And this is something you can only imagine that a business, it's a multi-billion dollar business, worries about in their bottom line. It is, you know, if my leaves have holes in them because they're perfectly fine insects that happen to be eating holes in them, people aren't going to buy that plant or whatnot. It's
a
business decision.
I think the aesthetic part of this really can't be underestimated. I mean, and I think that we all are sort of aware that we have aesthetics, right? We're wearing bell bottoms one decade. We're not wearing them another decade. Like that's what aesthetics are. They're what people like to look at. But we developed an aesthetic, which is, I want stuff to look like we're in Kentucky. I want it to look like Kentucky bluegrass as far as the eye can see. And that's just not what Minnesota's supposed to be. You know, so you can make a choice to have a lawn that looks like perfect Kentucky bluegrass. You know, I saw it on Leave It to Beaver. Or you can have a lawn that has clover in it. Clover is such a good thing for bees and other species and dandelions. I mean, like, we would have to have, I almost feel like we have to have a revolution. People write to me and they're like, oh, how do I talk to my elderly neighbor about dandelions? I want to leave them there. And this is not an insignificant thing. If you want to have a world with a thriving ecosystem and diversity and all of these plants that we want to have, and we don't even know what a lot of them are. We don't know what the little tiny bugs are and who they feed and what the whole food web is. If you want to have that, you have to be tolerant of a world that looks like nature.
Right. I want to circle. Thank you. I want to circle back around to that as far as like what, this is what I alluded to at the very beginning of this, is that what can we have in our front yards and backyards and what should we be planting? And, you know, so I think there's going to be a little bit about that on Twitter too, because I know there's at least one organization that wanted to come and distribute seeds tonight and we couldn't accommodate that. Was this right back there? All right, that guy, talk to him. Everybody's going to go talk to you. No? No? Not you. What? Oh, okay. He just has a question. Now people are going to be mobbed by him. Anyway, I'll find that person. I'm an idiot. All right, next question. We'll come back to that.
Well, I want to add a quick comment, too. When we talk about vegetables and things not looking perfect, I've read a lot of papers suggesting that there is evidence that says that when pests act on plants, it creates a stress reaction in the plant, which can also increase its antioxidants, which isn't that a big buzzword, for lack of a better word. But anyway, my question is, what's the incentive for big farmers who don't grow pollinator-dependent plants, like the corn farmers, who certainly have a huge impact on habitat destruction, and they also use the pesticides, which compound the problem. So how do we put incentives in place for those farmers to see some benefit to them?
I have imaginative ideas, but you might get real ideas.
I think there will probably be somewhat in line. There is, you know, everyone's working on this issue, or a lot of people are trying to work on this issue and find ways to capitalize on existing programs and conservation efforts. So, for example, there's a lot of focus here. There was an article in the paper on Monday morning by Josephine Marcotti in the Star Tribune about the buffers that are required around waterways and rivers, and there should be a 50-foot buffer. Nobody's enforcing it anyway. But so let's just stick with the idea of vegetative buffers. And what they're really focused on is protecting those waterways from things like sediment and nutrient runoff from farms and that sort of thing. Well, you can take those vegetative buffers and start to remold them for the purposes of pollinator habitat. So you can incentivize farmers to do what needs to be done to protect waterways from other things like nutrient losses from their farms, and then pay them extra or incentivize them in some other fashion to make those pollinator-rich habitats.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no reason why you couldn't have some kind of tax incentive for polyculture. There's no reason why the almond growers of California, obviously not our problem, but you know, they could have just flowers growing near the trees. They don't need to just only have almond trees. They could have things that support pollinators. Bumblebees are fantastic pollinators. They're actually, you know, in some instances better than honeybees and things like blueberries. So you could just interplant things. I mean, that would just be a decision we have to make as a culture. Like, oh, we don't need only almond trees altogether. We're willing to, you know, legislate something so that there are other species in there.
All right. So now did you want to say something on that?
Well, basically, incentive comes down to money. Okay. I mean, I'm sorry. That's where it's at. You know, if you're a farmer and you're growing corn and you're going to leave a 50-foot buffer, and I don't know the dollars, okay, but that amounts to a certain amount of money that he's not going to make, or she, because they couldn't plant corn there. That's what they're selling is corn. So if you want them to give up cropland, there's got to be a monetary incentive there.
And there are programs. We have at the Department of Agriculture's website, there's an entire conservation enhancement drop-down pick list, ability to go in and find out if I'm farming and I want to use the Conservation Reserve Program from the USDA NRCS or the EQIP program. I'm going to throw a bunch of jargon around. You can go look it up yourselves. But there are a number of incentive programs for planting land in conservation instead of planting it to corn, and you can compare and contrast the money that you would get through those programs. Now, we need to, you know, fund those fully at the federal and state level. We need to do what we can to make those programs as attractive as possible, but they do exist, and so we're trying to capitalize on some of that.
And we're spending a lot of money to support corn right now. I mean, so there was we've terraformed the Midwest for corn, and this was a foreign policy decision to get oil from the Midwest instead of from the Middle East. And obviously that has some trade-offs. I'm not saying that's the right thing to do, the wrong thing to do, but we're spending a lot of money right now to have corn be at an all-time high. Is that what we want to do? Do we want to tweak it some way or another?
Okay, so really before going any further, what I wanted to touch on is something that we talked about last week, Daria, when you were on the morning show with us, which is, and we asked the question, what is it that individuals can actually do short of, because we've gotten into some of the policy issues and the governmental issues and whatnot, We actually do have some power in this situation, as you alluded to a moment ago, to do something in our own yards. And what I was surprised about when Jill and I asked you on the show, you know, how effective really is that? And you said, it can make a significant difference to do something in your own yard. So let's talk about that right now and what that actually entails. And the thing that I really want to know is how many people really do have to do it. You know, I mean, do we have to get going? Like, do we have to? Does it have to be a massive cultural shift in order to be providing bee habitats? It's not going to be one person on a block planting certain things in their yard in order
it
to create bee habitats. Really?
They can fly. I mean, you know, it doesn't. They can.
That's awesome. I See, mean, that's great. Can.
It is. I'll tell you a story that I find really inspiring. There's a little bumblebee called the Rusty Patch Bumblebee. And I never heard of it before. I started following a bee researcher, you probably all know, named Elaine Evans. And she was explaining to me that this little bumblebee, and it's called a rusty patch because it has a little rusty patch on its butt. And it basically is endangered. Things are really bad. They're suing the federal government. But it can be found in two places that we know of, and that is basically near Lake Harriet and near Lake Como. So those are two places, and Elaine Evans just has a house in Midway neighborhood, and she has a bunch of plants in her front yard, and she has seen this endangered bumblebee in her front yard because people around there have flowers, and they're not putting out pesticides. And if you live within, you know, a mile, 2 miles of Lake Harriet or Lake Como, you could personally just go put out, you know, some Russian sage or some other things, and you could be providing the habitat. You know, the bald eagle was almost endangered. We now see them all over the place. This exact thing is happening now, but the habitat's much smaller, and the little animal is much smaller. So you got to look for them more carefully.
Do you guys want to add to that?
I don't think you need a lot of people to do it. You need what the bees need, primarily the native bees. They need flowering throughout the season. Okay. They don't store huge amounts of honey to get them through the bad patches like honeybees do. And so you need some that flower throughout the season. But no, it doesn't take a lot. You know, if you did a 10x10 patch in your backyard, you'll make a difference.
And I would just add that flowers are food for pollinators, not necessarily habitat. So we want to also read up and consider the other factors, like leaving sandy patches of soil available for ground burrowing bees, leaving sticks and twigs available standing instead of cleaning them out of your garden at the end
Don't
of the season.
Don't put down plastic first.
Yeah,
before
so
you do all
let's
this.
Not
yeah.
let's not confuse food with habitat. There are cross sections and intersections between the two, but we need to think about where they live, reproduce, where they overwinter, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and one of the things I love is that a lot of it is sort of not doing something. I have a colleague who's just going to leave kind of, you know, the area back by the property line alone. That's a huge thing that's going to be good for the bees, the wild, who knows, things that live near here.
So we got a lot of questions I want to get to, and I'm just going to go right here because it's the second hand that I saw come up. Then I'm going to venture out a little further afield. I hold the microphone.
You hold it. Sorry. So to echo Dara Moskowitz as the village idiot crier about bottled water, I'm a little bit sad to see there's bottled water on the table. But my question is, I know the focus is on neonicotinoids, but I'm in an environmental communications class at MCTC, and someone did a presentation on the effect of electromagnetic wave, you know, frequencies from our phones and things affecting bees. Is that science? Was that something he made up? Is that an effect on bees?
I'll throw that to the scientists. What do you got?
I have not looked into the effect of electromagnetic frequencies on bees. I think I've seen some reference to it. What are the other factors that might be affecting bee health and wild pollinator health? But I can't speak to the scientific underpinnings of that particular study.
So maybe just a bunch of woo-woo is what you're saying.
I didn't say that.
Don't know?
There's probably, I don't think there's anything to that. I really don't. There are bees right by radio towers. and I don't want to bring up the station because competing station, but a friend of mine is an engineer at one of the big radio stations, and his bees sit directly under a 5 million watt tower, so and they don't have a problem.
Okay, next question.
Comment and a question. So the comment is that in addition to the situation with bees, there are a number of other types of pollinators in the state that are really faring very poorly. So I'm at the Minnesota Zoo, and we work with prairie butterflies. And there's a prairie butterfly that used to be the most abundant butterfly in our prairies. And just in the last decade, it disappeared from Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota, and Iowa from 95% of its range. And we think that there are other issues that are similarly affecting other butterflies in the state. And so related to all this and bees, there's been a lot of activity at the state legislature talking about pollinators. And so do you have any suggestions for the people in the audience about what they should be contacting their legislator to ask, you know, for to do at the Capitol?
I would say contact me. I mean, I've been looking for someone to talk about these sort of unknown little bees and butterflies and other things for a long time. I found out about the Karner blue moths that are butterflies that are missing. These are the Lolita butterflies. These are Nabokov's butterflies, and they're gone. How dare we? How dare we have such an amazing mythic thing around us and just like, we didn't need that. We didn't even know it was here. I've heard about Luna moths, and part of it is that I can't get anyone to go on the record to say, oh, we used to have Luna moths, and now we don't, because you just kind of put it anecdotally out there, and people say, oh, we still have Luna moths. I saw one last year. I've never seen one, but I'd love, you know, if you can contact me, I'm love to talk to you. I am on Facebook and Twitter and stuff.
Next question.
Hi, I'm the idiot in the back. I just wanted to, as an environmental educator, I often like to play devil's advocate and be prepared for the questions that I think cynics might ask. And the big thing that I wonder about is, earlier you talked about especially non-native bees, whether they're honey or not. What do we say to the people who ask, well, they're non-native, they're exotic, introduced, however you want to define that, why do we care about them?
Because we're eating their work. They're working for us. There are little helper bees. What do you guys think?
Well, basically, okay, honeybees are the non-native bees, okay? But when this comes up, what I bring up to people is, except for a few people that I know, and I didn't see any out here, most of you are non-native, okay? So... And quite frankly, there are some natives that wish we would go home. So that's the thing. The honeybees are the non-native bees. The native bees are very important to our pollination, particularly in Minnesota. Okay, the crops that require pollination in Minnesota are not the big monocrops. When we have monocrops here, it's corn and soybeans. Okay, we don't have huge monocrops of the crops that require pollination. So native bees are doing a lot of pollination in Minnesota. Where the honeybees are required are where there are huge monocrops, particularly out on the coast, where the bees have to be taken in there in order to get pollination. Now, you can argue about whether that's a good way to feed the country and the world or not, and I don't want to get into an argument, but that's the way it is right now, and it's not going to change in the near future. Okay, so if you want good quality fruits and vegetables at a low cost, that's the way it's going to be.
Year round.
And, yeah. And if we don't want to protect, we need to protect the honeybees from that aspect. And, you know, quite frankly, we also have to protect the beekeeping industry because the bees fly, but they don't fly from Minnesota to California. And so it requires beekeepers to do that. So that the native bees, yeah, that's why we care about them, because the way things are right now, we can't do it without them.
And on the issue of non-native species, perhaps helpful to point out that we do have non-native or invasive species like Japanese beetle, if you've ever suffered through an onslaught of that in your garden, or emerald ash borer, if you had a favorite ash tree, that are controlled by these same neonicotinoids. And there are some other options to control those invasive species that can wreak a lot of havoc on the landscape and in your gardens. So it's not like neonicotinoids are the only things that control them, but they do play a role in the control of some pretty nasty bugs that nobody really wants.
Yeah, and let me just put a thing out there for another reason to like honeybees is because they make delicious honey. And it's also, in addition to being tasty, it's good for you. It helps you kind of combat allergies. It's a way for you to interact with pollen. It's in a good, healthy way. So, and they're beautiful, and they're a magical thing, and we shouldn't just toss them out and just eat Fritos. I mean, that's what we're looking at, right? That's the option, is that we just get rid of everything that's in the produce section, and we just eat corn.
Here's a question from Twitter. What actually is wrong with industrialized pollination?
I don't think it exists, for one thing.
No? All right, on to our next question.
Hello. I think this is a great program. Now, my question has to do with spreading the word. This is the University of Minnesota area. We're a very liberal base here. What are we doing out in Stearns County and areas like that to talk about this?
Well, refer back to some of the issues that we've been directed by the legislature to undertake and that we're engaging at the Department of Agriculture and with our colleagues at a variety of state agencies. There's education and outreach to farmers and farm groups and the urban residents of those areas as well. I think we're a cosmopolitan enough state that Stearns County should not be equated with only farmers and only people who aren't well-educated or aware of things. So there's an effort to educate and inform people across the entire state about this issue.
Next question.
Does anyone know if Monsanto is currently developing a robotic pollinator? I'm actually not kidding. I'm not kidding.
I don't know.
You said there's no industrialized pollination, but is that something that's even a possibility?
Well, I mean, I guess now that I think about it, I mean, industrialized pollination could refer to, 60% of the bees in the United States right now have been trucked to the almond fields in California. I think that's the right number. And so what's wrong with that? It's kind of messed up. Like, it's not, why are we driving bees around the country? Why don't we just have bees where they want to be? Why don't we interplant native species to allow native pollinators to work? I mean, and I think that just like any, intensive agriculture, when you have a lot of critters together, they spread disease among themselves. It's better to have them a little more separate, just kind of like a nursery school of babies. They all get a cold, and then they all get a cold.
Also, if we're trucking these bees all around the country to do all this stuff, aren't they getting tired? I'm actually not joking.
Oh,
aren't they being overworked?
We talked about stressors earlier, like mites and viruses, and the process of taking bees to another location from Minnesota to California in a truck in all sorts of weather along the way across mountain passes, hoping that you've provided them with enough food for the journey in the form of fake nectar, and then bringing them back home or taking them to their next pollination place is a stress, and it contributes to the death of colonies in the process.
And I think that one of the things that's confused the issue is that a lot of beekeepers say, like, oh, it's not neonicotinoids. It's I think they call it PPB, piss poor beekeeping, right? That's the thing. So, if you take a lot of there are some bad beekeepers, and they take the honey away from the hive for the winter and make them deal with sugar water, and then they die. Well, who's surprised about that? But it's, it's one of the many factors.
Next question.
I live in Minneapolis. There's a lot of parks. There's a lot of empty lots. There's a lot of edges to things. It may not be enough to just leave them alone with pesticides and spray them, but are there resources to tell us how to help cultivate bee-friendly areas, and what are those resources?
I'll bet there are, and I'll bet if you looked at hashtag policy and policy point right now, you might find some. I actually, I can't look at the entire thread, but that was the idea, actually. Go ahead.
Edu.
Say it again.
Blab.umn.edu.
Yeah, they have an amazing list of native
plants
and helpful plants.
What are good and The DNR
has
a good list.
The Minnesota
Xerxes
DNR
has
a list of trees, native trees. I think that's if there's like the laziest thing you could do, you could put in a native tree. Like you don't think like, oh, native trees provide pollen, but actually they do. Linden trees are a great source of food and a great native plant. And if you're really ambitious, you could contact Prairie Restorations, which is a garden company, and they will come and turn your whole yard into a prairie for you. So there's different levels of how much you want to do. I would say the least you could do is not poison everything. You know, the most you could do is just start restoring a prairie, and that can be done.
Okay, so I'm going to trust that's going to get onto those URLs. We'll get submitted to the record, and we'll push forward here.
I'm wondering how neonicotinoids are, because I know nicotine has been used as a pesticide for a long time. And did the advent of neonicotinoids coincide with the bee colony collapse syndrome?
Yes. What was the year that neonicotinoids became popular? 2008?
Well, the first big one was introduced in 1994.
94.
But again, there's causation and causality and correlation versus causality. There are a number of other factors like the rise in varroa mite and viruses and other unchecked stressors to bees that could also be correlated with colony collapse disorder. But pesticides and neonicotinoids were introduced and took off, especially this certain subclass of neonicotinoids, at about some of the same time that some of these colony collapse issues arose.
It seems to me that with all of the public right-of-ways on railroad tracks and county and federal lands that we could do and adopt a highway toward native species idea that could be a combination of local elementary schools, local businesses, and the property owners to create these rich areas of bee-friendly habitats.
I think that's a great idea, and I think that people are thinking that. That's a fantastic idea.
The Minnesota Department of Transportation is looking at modifying roadside vegetation management to be more friendly to pollinators to support it. The DNR is doing some of the same thing. The work groups that Gary and I are working on are developing some best management practices for roadsides and rights of ways to facilitate people's understanding of what they can do in those situations.
I think this is where we fit in the update about the Washington, D.C.
Shall we do that? Shall we fit in the update about...
Yeah.
Okay, so let's remind everyone. So Marla Spivak is your associate, Gary, at the...
boss, actually.
She's your boss.
Let's be honest.
I wasn't actually sure, and I didn't want to say, but now that you mention it...
He would have liked to make the trip
but
to Washington.
She's the boss.
Okay. So... We had been in communication with her, and she said, "You know, I have something else going on that night. I've been invited to the White House to talk about this issue. So, what is the update, Dara?"
Well, I just love that. Like Barack Obama would be here, right? If he could be,
right?
He stole our guest.
So, Steve, you got
so this is
we got you.
You got bumped for the president.
You're really funny, though. I'm barely enjoying you.
All right. So Marla texted me earlier. Said the main message is that Obama asks frequently, "How are the bees doing?" And I asked her, "So, do you have time to tell him there are a lot of different bees?" And she said, "No." But the people at the meeting were just Toyota, Boeing, Pacific Gas, and utility rights of way, highways, waste management people, Farm Bureau. They're all willing to plant plants for pollinators. So all of these top science advisors, a whole bunch of private entities. She said, "I got verklempt. It was awesome." So good.
That's awesome. Man, let's have some more drinks. Seriously, I rarely have such a positive vibe. I know one of you guys had your hand up first. I think it was you, maybe, for a really long time. I'll get to you in just a moment.
Well, my original question was about the impact of herbicides, but I just wanted to comment. Somebody asked about what's going on in outstate Minnesota. We visit Itasca County a lot, and what they have been doing through their Planning Commission and Board of Adjustment is when anybody who lives on a lake wants a variance for some reason, One of the conditions almost always these days is they have to put in a 30 to 50 foot buffer to the lake. It's managed through the Soil and Water Conservation District and so forth. So there is something kind of going on, and there's supposed to be native plantings in the area. So anyway,
that's
just
great.
That's what's happening. But still about the herbicides, do they have an
impact?
Yeah,
can I answer that herbicide question?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Okay, that's kind of the other side of the, at least in Minnesota, the monocrop thing, and I did allude to, you know, corn and soybeans and that, you know, they don't need pollination. But what used to be the case was that within the rows of corn were weeds, okay? And I'm just close your ears for a minute. I get in trouble talking about bees liking weeds, but there were weeds growing in between. There were flowers, which was food for the bees. And now, with the GMO, they just spray the field with Roundup. The only thing that's left is the corn. There's no weeds. And that's taken away a lot of food for the bees. And so it is a big factor.
And that's the butterflies problem, too, is that the Roundup gets rid of milkweed.
Yeah.
Milkweed used to be, you know, rich in all the fields. And this is all a new thing. And this is, I've recently evolved on this, where for many years I sort of stood on the sidelines of the GMO question. I thought, well, what's the difference between GMOs and hybridizing, really? I don't quite get it. I don't want, you know, I'm not going to come out against it. And then just recently I realized, well, in practice, what GMO means is Roundup ready. And so what it actually means is that we've got, I think the last year we had numbers for us, 2011, 28 million pounds of Roundup, of glyphosate, the active ingredient Roundup, much more Roundup sprayed than that. So 28 million pounds of glyphosate applied to the state of Minnesota. That's a lot of poison.
And so, do I understand correctly, we've engineered crops essentially to be resistant to the pesticide. That's what Roundup Ready means, right?
Yeah, so right. It just means that, you know, so it would ordinarily kill all plants, and then It's engineered so that it doesn't kill the corn. And the same thing, there's Roundup Ready cotton, there's Roundup Ready soybeans. And cotton seems to be the bellwether for this, because now there's all kinds of Roundup-resistant bugs, and they have all kinds of problems. They're super weeds.
There you go.
Be on the lookout.
What
super
a shock,
weeds.
Right?
Yeah.
That's what you get.
Yeah, so okay. 2015, 2016, I predict great stories will be about a lot of super weeds coming our way.
Super weeds.
Hi. Thanks, you guys, for coming and doing the talk. This is super, super fun and informative. I used to work for Second Harvest Heartland, which is a huge food bank in the area. We serve 59 counties of Minnesota and western Wisconsin. And a lot of our produce that we got into the hunger relief system was because farmers were growing way too much, because they knew that the companies that were going to buy and kind of manufacture the corn and the potatoes, sweet potatoes, carrots, all these different things, they knew that the companies purchasing their produce and marketing it were going to turn down 70-80% of what they grew because it didn't look right. And so what I'm thinking is, like, a lot of these farmers are growing all this stuff to meet the marketers and to meet the demand of the U.S. economy, who's kind of like saying, I need my carrots to look perfect. I need my flowers to look perfect. All these things. And so we're just destroying all this land just for farms and for crops. We need more GMOs. We need more pesticides. We need more of this. We need more of that. When really, what kind of things could we do to focus our attention on the consumer? How can we change the consumer's point of view to say, hey, you know, as long as my food is nutritious, I don't care if there's a tiny hole in it or if there's this defect or whatever. You know, how can we kind of start to shift the perspective to the consumer?
I think that's aesthetic
like a
thing again.
Question.
Yeah.
That's a what? What'd you say?
That's an aesthetic question again.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that a lot of these aesthetics questions, I often feel like my people are the people of the cubicles. Like, we can do this. Like, we can, you know, start talking to each other and create this change. the first time I did a CSA box and the first time I saw a cabbage worm in a plant, I was just floored. I was like, what is this thing doing in my food? And then I slowly, you know, realized like, oh, this is the natural world, and these things are pretty easy to kill. And they're also, my child likes them as pets. She takes a cabbage worm outside. You know, so it just... I grew up in New York City. You know, I didn't have an understanding of cabbage worms, and you just have to deal with it and talk to each other and move on. The other thing that we haven't talked about is exotic plants in our gardens. I mean, we can grow anything from anywhere, but local pollinators need local plants. They can't do anything with, you know, a ginkgo tree. I mean, I was just looking at our gardening website the other day, and it was like, it has no known pests. It's like, it has no known pests here. It has plenty of pests in its native South Africa. You know, what we're really also saying about that plant is it's not food for anything. You know, we need to be growing blazing stars that are from here. We need to be growing... Yeah, I'm sure these guys could fill in 1,000 plants that we need to be growing that are plants of here, and then they're gonna, and then we need to appreciate them, and we need to. One of the things that Marla taught me was she was like, we need to change our aesthetics and look at a landscape that is moving and crawling as alive. And I just thought, okay, whatever. And I went home and I just decided to stand in front of my flower garden, and I just stood there. And I just looked and looked and looked and looked. And, you know, like, just meditatively just standing there. I was going to see what happened. And not, you know, 5-7 minutes into this, this little bright green metallic, it's called a metallic green sweat bee. But I thought of it as a disco bee because it just looked so awesome. It was, like, green and tiny and sparkly all over. And it just, like, zipped in. I was like, oh, where'd that thing come from? And then it zipped away. And I have now realized that if I just stand and look at my flower garden for 5 minutes, it will show up. And it's like a little ice skater sparkle bee. Like, I love this thing. It's the most awesome little thing. But I had no aesthetic to appreciate it before I just stood there waiting for it. And that's an aesthetic shift. Now I feel like I have a pet. Like, this is great.
The bling bee.
Yeah.
Sparkle bee. I love it.
I'd like to go back to the industrial pollinator category for a second. And I just saw the documentary More Than Honey, which I thought was amazing, and I'd highly recommend to anybody here tonight. And watching these industrial beekeepers basically driving their hives all over the country and accepting 50 to 75% loss of their livelihood because of the behavior of the people that they're selling their service to, like, how much of that are they going to accept? When are they going to say to these orchards in particular, stop spraying while my bees are out here pollinating your trees? You know, where's the tipping point where they'll finally say something? You know, what's the economic incentive?
Yeah.
Well, I can point to a recent story from California where the service providers, the beekeepers, did just that with the almond growers. This was January, March time frame. They sat down and met with the almond growers to say, you know, we can either continue to accept these losses or we're going to try to take our business elsewhere and not come back here because you're destroying our livelihood. And it was a discussion, three-way discussion, I guess, with almond growers and the Environmental Protection Agency and the beekeepers. And so those discussions are starting, and people are reaching their tipping point or their limit. There were 80,000 hive losses, I think, related to that incident.
Hi. You touched on the fact that people should plant native plants if you want to feed and build habitats for pollinators. I was wondering if you could just touch on what people who live in condos and apartments can do to build their own little pollinator pot, if there's some plants you could recommend.
I totally have a plant I can recommend, and Yay. It's also will get you a mojito. It's called mint. So you can just plant a bunch of mint, and if you let it go and just let it get as big and crazy as it will and just flower, 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 you will be amazed at what comes to you. So I've thought about this, that you could put like a sunflower in the middle and mint all around, and then you could just have mojitos all summer, and you would be so happy.
Where's the? Where do we grow the sugar cane for the rum, though?
Excellent. Next question.
So first, if you guys love all this information, U of M, B Lab, the classes
for beekeeping was awesome. You like Gary now, see him in his true element up on stage with all of his equipment. And it's not just for those that want to become beekeepers. It was a great educational experience. Some can beekeep, some, you know, I'm not saying everyone should just go buy a hive and start raising bees. But it is a feat to have bees in the city. You need your neighbors. You need all these rules and regulations. So this is just a outpouring of, if you see that petition of that neighbor of yours, hear them out. Bees aren't, you know, if it's in the proper place, it's not going to sting you, your dog. You know, there's ways to get around that. Secondly, Gary, you need to update your Twitter feed. You are too hilarious to not post anything on Twitter. Can you guys speak more to city ordinances, what we can do to help our neighbors become the beekeeper that they want to do, they want to help out, and a question of, is there going to be any lessening? I know they lessened the permits, but is there any future lessening on those ordinances?
And again, we're to make it very clear, we're talking about beekeeping here, which is very distinct from just, you know, growing things that are habitats for bees and whatnot. So beekeeping.
I guess if I understand the question, the beekeeping in the city, that it's just incredible. I mean, this is why so many people are here tonight, I think, that there's this big interest in bees and beekeeping. And for those of you that know me, I can talk forever about it. But when someone asks about what can we do to get our people to accept a produce that's maybe not perfect, okay? Well, these are things you have to get over. And when you're talking about bees and you're talking about what they need, and then you have to go to the produce people and say, okay, you're buying this stuff. The most fun is to go to a produce section and watch people look at stuff and put it down and then go see why they didn't take it. Oh, my gosh. You know? That's what pocket knives are for, okay? Throw that away, okay? And those are things that, you're right, that the consumer is going to have to accept those kinds of imperfections if we're going to try to reduce the use of pesticides. That's just the way it's going to be.
I am seeing a lot of cool stuff at hashtag Policy Pint that is resources for you. Find out what you can plant, where you can find them. Again, please add to that thread there on Twitter. Next question.
I was wondering, can it really help to rotate your crops in these mega farms and things? I mean, is there a way to really incentivize or just help people understand that rotation of your crops would help this problem, or is that not really true?
It's partly true. It depends on what you rotate to, if it's pollinator friendly or not, if that's what you're looking for, additional pollinator food or habitat. But the issue of getting additional crops on the landscape, get involved in the farm bill and farm policy discussions. That's the way to make that change. There are incredible forces and policies that support the production of certain crops and incentivize the production of those crops. So,
yeah, they used to let fields go to clover. That was a thing that went for generations, right? We would have an alternate clover year, and that would put nitrogen in the soil because that's what clover does, and it's also a tasty food for all kinds of pollinator species. And I think that's one of the reasons that I like grass-fed beef is that it's just kind of, you know, I buy Thousand Hills or I buy another grass-fed beef producer because those are just fields with stuff in it that's not corn or soybeans in it. I just feel like those are those important oases to keep species going.
Steve, you mentioned there are a lot of resources on the hashtag that we can check on, but I'm curious. There's a lot of plant sellers that are selling plants that they say are bee-friendly. And so we don't get duped as consumers by things that are natural or organic. Yeah. Are there any sort of regulatory effects in place or things that we can do as consumers to buy things that are actually friendly?
Funny you should ask.
Excellent question.
So just in the past yesterday, as a matter of fact, the House of Representatives passed a bill that was authored and by Representative Rick Hansen out of Dakota County and co-sponsored by a number of others, passed a very wide bipartisan margin in the House that would require the labeling of he bills it as a truth in labeling law, so that if plants are labeled as beneficial to pollinators or pollinator friendly, that they cannot have been treated with or have a detectable level of neonicotinoids or other systemic pesticides that are harmful to bees. Now, it's a great step forward, and many people in the audience who were part of getting that off the ground. It's passed the House. It still has to move through the Senate. And so if you're interested in that kind of truth in labeling legislation and assuring that choice for consumers, get in touch with your senators and watch the progress of that bill on the floor and or through conference committee if the differences need to be resolved in conference committee.
But until then, I mean, it's not very friendly to say so, but I would just avoid the big box stores. I mean, Home Depot and Lowe's, I mean, there's a great chance that your tomato that you get from a big box store right now is going to have neonicotinoids in it. And if it has that, it's going to actually kill the thing that needs to you need to get your tomatoes. So it's a silly thing. But I would try to seek out your, you know, producers that are more, that have whatever said that they will do this. I mean, it's just a word. It's just people on their word right now. But I would try to seek out plants this season. And maybe in the future, if this law goes through, we'll all be happier. But seek out people that are saying they're neonicotinoid free, and I would take them at their word.
Yeah, but the point being, that's the start. That's where you at least start until we get the law right. Next
question. But even without the neonicotinoids, how do you know it's a bee-friendly plant?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
And that's where, you know, when you go to the store, bring your list with you. Okay, just because the nursery store says it's bee-friendly, okay, look up the Latin name or whatever that is, and then look on your little chart and see if it really is.
And if it's native, a number of the things that Dara's been pointing out, yeah, other factors to consider.
I have a question. In terms of, well, how do I say this? You said that right now North America and Europe seem to be affected. In terms of South America, what are they using as pollinators? Have they seen an issue with the pollinators decreasing? Do they have an issue with the honeybees?
I'm not up on this. I know that the coffee crop is endangered, some say, because of problems with pollinators, but is anybody South America?
And is there a way to look at what they're doing to see if we could?
There are a number of reports. I don't have their titles at my fingertips. I believe some of them have probably been posted or linked at the Bee Labs website, but there are a number of studies that have looked at the global issue to see where and in which ways. For example, Australia has certain conditions where colony collapse or disorder does not seem to be as prevalent, and yet they use neonicotinoids. So that's just one example from a number of reports that have tried to evaluate the global impact of these issues. So I have to just go out on your favorite search engine and poke around. You'll find some things.
South America has killer bees, so.
Yeah.
We don't want to bring them up here.
All right, this is where I have to apologize for not being able to get to everyone. We had so many questions tonight. Again, this conversation can continue on Twitter, and I do hope it does, hashtag PolicyPint. We're going to also have the audio for this online soon, and we'll let you know at the Twitter feed as well when that's going to happen. So I've got time for one more question here.
So you had mentioned that different parasites are affecting the bee population. Is that mostly the honeybees that are coming together from all across the country, or are they affecting the native species, and if so, why the rise?
They're primarily we know they're about the honeybees, again, because we're watching them more closely. In general, the things that affect honeybees are not the same things that affect native bees. You know, just like they talk about how, you know, your dog has less bacteria than you do, and in reality, it has more dog bacteria, just not human bacteria, that kind of thing. Okay, so there are issues with native bees. There are some. They get Nosema, they get wax moths, they have their own things. We just we're not as close to them as we are to the honeybee issues.
Gary Reuter, Dara Moskowitz-Kromdahl, Joseph Zuckman, thank you all very much for being a wonderful panel tonight. Thank you all
thank
for being
you.
Here.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for having us.
What an excellent show, and again, just such great enthusiasm for this topic tonight. I want to thank Target and Minnesota Credit Union Network for being our sponsors. Thank you very much. Citizens League, Sean Kershaw, Adam Arling, Jane Solinger, and Ali Lozoff from Minnesota Public Radio for helping me out, as always. And thanks to all of you very much for coming and for your enthusiasm. And we'll see you tomorrow morning on the radio. And we'll be making an announcement soon about what our next program is. See you next time. Thanks so much.